I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Mondays at 1, it's all things political on this Monday when the boys of summer return to Miller Park in Milwaukee. It's baseball again. Good sign. Tulips are coming up and daffodils. And we have a lot of politics to talk about this hour. As you just heard on the news from NPR, Senate Democrats do now have enough support to block the nomination of Neil Gorsuch. They needed 41 votes to filibuster. They have that, and now it appears that there will be a rule change. What does that mean? We're going to be looking at tax reform. What does the administration have in the planning stages for tax reform? How difficult will that be considering what happened with health care? What about infrastructure spending? Our guest this hour knows a great deal about infrastructure spending. When does the president plan to roll out a plan, and how much will it cost? And will it get Republican support? Russia, of course, continues to dominate news stories. We'll talk about Russia. We'll talk about health care and Jared Kushner, whose role gets bigger and bigger as the days go on, is in Iraq today. We will talk about that as well as whatever else you would like to discuss. Our guest this hour is Mark Niquette. He is a government reporter for Bloomberg News, focusing on infrastructure. He has covered for Bloomberg municipal finance, state government issues, and national politics. And he has Wisconsin connections. Grew up in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, and received his degree in history from the very fine Lawrence University in Appleton. And we thank you very much, Mark, for being with us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. Our number, by the way, I don't think I did that, is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to receive your messages. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Well, let's start with the news that the Democrats now have enough votes, 41 votes, to filibuster. What happens next now with Neil Gorsuch? The Republicans change their rules? What are they doing?
Yeah, that seems to be the next play here. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was on a Sunday talk show yesterday, and basically said that Neil Gorsuch would be confirmed by the end of the week, one way or the other. And by that, he was suggesting that if Democrats didn't get enough votes, they could get 60 and confirm him that way. But if Democrats were able to filibuster, which it looks like they will be able to, he was willing to use the so-called nuclear option, which essentially means for Supreme Court nominees, they would only need a majority vote, not the 60 votes that have traditionally been needed to get a Supreme Court nominee on the bench.
Mm-hmm. And do the Republicans run a risk if they take that option?
Well, it changes a long-standing Senate tradition. The Senate has always been sort of known as a deliberative body, takes more time to debate and pass measures, and part of that tradition was, you know, not just having a majority vote to pass, in this case, a Supreme Court nominee. And we've seen that chip away over time. The Democrats in 2013 changed the rules to essentially allow nominees below the Supreme Court level to get confirmed just on a majority vote. But, you know, we've been sort of holding out this idea that for Supreme Court nominees, we wanted to have 60 votes to ensure that this was the finest person we could put on the bench and that there was, you know, bipartisan support for that person. And, you know, the fact that we're getting to the point of maybe changing that rule just shows how divided, you know, government really is and how polarized our politics really are in Washington.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that it's objection to Gorsuch, or is it still that the Democrats are very upset about what happened with Garland?
It's a little bit of both, I think. There's clearly hard feelings from the fact that President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, and he never got a hearing or a vote because the Republicans took the position that, you know, was too far down the track in the presidential election, and the next president should have the pick. So Democrats are upset that they didn't get, you know, any kind of consideration there. But there's also objections to Neil Gorsuch by some Democrats who think he's too pro-corporate, you know, he would not, you know, be aligned with their interests. So it's probably a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm. Al Franken, Senator Franken, had some interesting comments that were on the news that he said, what we're looking at now is, and I wonder if there's any way of knowing this, decision after decision after decision that will be 5-4.
Yeah, that's sort of, you know, where I guess it's headed. I mean, he's replacing Antonin Scalia on the bench, who was part of the conservative five-vote sort of block that voted on a lot of these bills. And, you know, we've seen votes, you know, since he's been off the court after he died, you know, 4-4 ties. So the thinking is that he would, you know, go into that back to that 5-4 block. And really, part of what's going on with this debate over changing the Senate rules is, the expectation that there could be one or two more appointees coming down mm-hmm. soon from President Trump, that, you know, we have a couple older justices who might be retiring or leaving the bench and during the time that President Trump's in office. So, you know, it's a fight not just about Neil Gorsuch, but maybe the next couple of nominees that would be coming.
Let's talk about infrastructure for a moment. I'm surprised that the president didn't put out a plan much earlier. I would have thought it would have been maybe number two or even number one on his agenda, considering how popular it was on the campaign trail. What has happened? I understand there were planning sessions set for early in March for his $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Have those meetings been taking place? Is this going to be on the agenda, but it'll be after tax reform?
Yeah, meetings are taking place, and they are putting together a plan. And you're right, there was some thought that the administration would have started with infrastructure, in part because the thinking was, you know, there could be bipartisan support for this. You know, investing in infrastructure is something that Democrats and Republicans have supported. In fact, you know, there's been talk for a long time that infrastructure is not a partisan issue. Everybody sort of recognizes the need. But I think part of what happened was there were clearly congressional priorities, too, in terms of what the legislative priorities, you know, calendar should be. And I think the Republicans were very much in favor of starting with trying to repeal and replace Obamacare first, and then have changes in the tax code, cutting taxes, reforming things in the tax code second, and then infrastructure was third. And I think, you know, the administration might now be a little sorry that they didn't sort of start with infrastructure, because they might have been able to get sort of something passed, and that would have maybe generated more goodwill to tackle some of these more contentious issues like health care and taxes. But the plan is being put together, as far as we know, and the expectation is, we've heard the budget director and the Secretary of Transportation suggest that we could see a plan in the summer or early fall. It's a little unclear yet exactly what that will look like or how far reaching it will be, because to this point we've seen a lot of, you know, hints and pieces of what this infrastructure plan might look like, but not a lot of detail and definitive sort of hints about what the frame and scope will be.
And when you say could get something passed, do you mean, Mark, because there would have been Democratic support? Because I would imagine there wouldn't be a lot of Republican support for a $1 trillion infrastructure plan?
Well, the key all along and going forward for sure will be how much of the plan includes additional federal spending versus incentives or efforts to leverage the private sector to get more private money invested in infrastructure. Part of what the president has talked about, you know, going back to the campaign, is that he wants to see more private investment in roads, bridges, and airports, other kinds of projects. The idea being that we have what are called public-private partnerships, where the public sector can work with the private sector to get private investment for deals. And, you know, the feeling is that you could get more work done if the private sector was involved, because they can get work done more quickly and more efficiently in some cases than the traditional public ways of financing and funding projects. And sort of the fight in Washington is going to be about how much additional tax money, direct federal spending, is included in addition to these efforts to get private investment. Because there's, I think, pretty much general agreement that we're not going to get to $1 trillion by, you know, just leveraging the private sector, getting private money in. Because part of what has to happen with these public-private partnerships is you need some kind of revenue stream to provide the rate of return for the private sector to invest its money. This usually falls in the form of tolls, like if it's a tollway that you're privatizing or doing a public-private partnership on, or a user fee or some kind of tax payment. And the argument is, well, that's fine in sort of heavily urbanized areas, but, you know, not really going to work in Wyoming and areas where there's just not a lot of people or low-income areas. So, you know, the thought is we need more public investment to get more of this work done, particularly in areas that aren't going to support private investment. But you have a Republican-controlled Congress that really doesn't want to add to the deficit. I mean, they're still sort of upset with, you know, the stimulus package that was passed under President Obama was about $800 billion. they don't want to see anything that looks like a stimulus package that would add to the debt and deficit. So while they might support some public spending, additional spending, you know, it's unclear to what extent. So part of the fight that's going to be going on is what is that mix between public and private and whatever infrastructure plan emerges.
Mm. And tell me about, the president has obviously been having some problems getting his agenda through Congress, starting off with health care. It went down pretty badly. It was an embarrassment for him and for Paul Ryan and all of this dissension among Republicans. I'm wondering, is this just growing pains, people who are in office who have never had elected office before? Is he going to learn quickly so that he can get some major piece of legislation passed? Because he's going to need something.
Yeah, and we'll find out. I mean, I think there's clearly some sense that, you know, because this was an administration and individuals coming into the White House who did not have government experience, that, you know, it would hurt their ability to get, you know, legislation approved. And part of what you saw happen with the health care debate was the White House kind of outsourcing the development of the plan and passage of it to Paul Ryan and you know, the leadership in the House. They essentially put together the health care plan, and we saw what happened. I mean, the president obviously was out there trying to get it passed and selling it and meeting with members and so forth, but ultimately it was a congressional plan. And you're seeing, you know, evidence that, you know, the White House thinking that probably wasn't the best way to go, or maybe not the right way for the White House. For example, you're getting some hints that, as you know, we shift towards trying to get something passed, a tax bill passed, that, you know, the White House might produce its own plan as opposed to letting Congress write a plan that the White House would get behind.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the White House putting together its own plan, written and figured out by who?
Well, by the White House staff. In this case, for tax purposes, it would be the Office of Economic Counsel, other folks who are involved in tax policy, who would actually put together, you know, if nothing else, the guts of what would become a bill that would move through the Congress.
Mm-hmm. Jared Kushner is, surprise, surprise, in Iraq today as a White House envoy. His son-in-law is taking on a whole lot of responsibilities here, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, because he's been talked about everything from, you know, coming up with a Middle East peace plan to criminal justice reform. And as you say, he's in Iraq now, you know, I guess at the request of, you know, the military there. And last week they also announced that he's going to be overseeing a sort of a new innovation office within the White House to try and bring sort of private sector, business, common sense reforms to information technology or procurement, other sort of nuts and bolts of government. So, you know, he certainly has a lot on his plate.
Mm-hmm. Obviously very close to the president. Who else is?
Well, is interesting, Jared's wife, Ivanka Trump, is now taking an office in the White House. That was the other news we got last week, that she was sort of informally advising her father, and we learned that she's now going to have sort of an official role unpaid, but as sort of a White House employee working with her father. And we've seen other people who were close to the president, either in his private life as a developer in New York, or, you know, during the campaign as he was running for president, come into the office, like Steve Bannon, who was with Breitbart and was sort of chief strategist on his campaign, and other individuals that would have some connection to the president, either politically or through the business world.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Russia for a moment. This story will not go away. I watch a bit of television in the evenings and over the weekend, and it's amazing how many of the cable outlets, not Fox, but the other networks, are on this story, on this story, on this story, hour after hour after hour. Is a couple questions. Is the House investigation, do you think, pretty much over at this point? Will the Senate be hearing from those in the Trump administration, or used to be in the Trump administration, who say they want to testify? Kushner, Manafort, Page, and Stone, will they appear before the Senate Intelligence Committee? Do you think that it's going to take a whole long time for this story to develop? And do you think it's as big a story as many believe, or maybe not?
Yes, yes, and yes. it seems pretty clear that the House Intelligence Committee investigation is in doubt. I mean, we've had all this controversy over the chairman, Devin Nunes, sort of going to the White House and reportedly, you know, getting some information that he then briefed the president on, and questions about whether that can operate as an independent sort of investigatory body now, because of his ties to the president. But you've seen sort of the Senate step up. There was a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing last week, and sort of the mood there was very much along the lines of, okay, we're going to be adults here, and we're going to treat this and do this right. So you could see some, you know, really broad and I think probing activity by the Senate Intelligence Committee, even if we're not sure what's going to happen in the House yet. But there's just all these moving pieces to this, you know, investigation. You know, we have sort of the clear understanding that Russia attempted to influence the presidential election last year. I mean, there's clear evidence and I think consensus agreement that there was hacking of emails and the Russians were behind it. And, you know, the Russians clearly were trying to undermine the election and, you know, in some ways destabilize our democracy. What's less clear is how does that relate to the presidential campaign itself, and specifically Donald Trump's campaign. The FBI director testified that, you know, they were actually investigating whether there was any kind of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians as part of this broader effort to undermine democracy. So I think we want to find out all of it. We want mm-hmm. to, you know, learn to what extent, you know, the Russians had success in undermining the election, but also, you know, answer definitively whether there was any kind of collusion with the Russians and the Trump campaign, either during the election or in the you know, the weeks of the transition leading up to his inauguration. And we've seen sort of pieces of this starting to emerge. We had, you know, the former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn offer to provide testimony under immunity, and mm-hmm. that set off a whole, you know, another sort of storyline about what should happen with that and what does that mean. Bottom line, there's just a lot of questions out there, and I think it is going to take time to get answers to everything that people want to have answers for.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Mark was talking about Michael Flynn asking for immunity. Before we go to your phone calls, let's hear just briefly from the ranking Democratic member on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. These are his statements regarding immunity for Michael Flynn.
Well, I think we start out with a very healthy skepticism. We know from the filings that were dumped by the White House on Friday that General Flynn failed to report the money that he received from that RT propaganda arm of the Kremlin, as well as two other Russian entities. We also have requested the background security documents that General Flynn filled out to find out whether he similarly failed to disclose work that he was doing as a financial agent of a foreign power or receiving financial support from a foreign power. And, of course, there's the issue of whether General Flynn made false statements that would also expose him to liability. So there's a lot we need to learn before entertaining anything like this. There's a lot we need to learn from other witnesses. But I start out, I think, with a very healthy skepticism.
For you to be with us this hour, it's 800-486-8655. Mark Niket is our guest, government reporter for Bloomberg News. And we've been talking about infrastructure and tax reform and healthcare and the Russia story. I was interested, I'm wondering where you fall on the answer to this question. Do you think there should be an independent prosecutor on the possible coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians for the election? 52% of Americans say yes, but only a quarter of Republicans say that they would favor such an independent probe. Do you think that the president should move ahead on infrastructure and do that quickly, that it would be good for his supporters to see a major infrastructure plan? What about tax reform? What about who's close to the president? Jared Kushner in Iraq. He's got his plate full, doesn't he? He's doing everything these days. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Mike in St. Lawrence. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Kathleen. Yeah, I got a question. I don't know if it's relative to Jared Kushner or not, but the meeting with the premier from China this week is important to North Korea. And I as I told your screener, I think I recall that the United States has never signed the armistice with North Korea. And I think that the United States and North Korea and South Korea are still at war, technically speaking, in paper. And I remember even back when George Bush became president, that was brought up, that North Korea really wants to end the war. Does that make any sense? I don't know if your guest would have an answer for that or not, but something I was thinking about this morning.
Yeah. Are you worried about North Korea, Mike?
I am worried for South Korea about North Korea, yes, because if we make any kind of moves on North Korea and we don't totally obliterate, there are probably hundreds of thousands of mortar rounds and cannons and artillery. Seoul is going to be a wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it worries me a lot. It really does. I mean, this guy has not backed off going back to Clinton. He's been slowly slugging along, and now he's got nuclear warheads, and now he's got missiles. And
right.
Give him another 5 or 6 years, and maybe he will reach the United States,
right,
or Japan, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mark.
Yeah, I don't know the history or what the situation with the war is between the two countries, but I think the caller's right. I mean, a clear focus of the meeting with the Chinese president, with President Trump this week, will be North Korea. In fact, the president gave an interview to the Financial Times over the weekend, or at least it was published on Sunday, that said that the U.S. is prepared to sort of unilaterally deal with North Korea if it has to, but wants China to cooperate. The thinking is that if the U.S. and China work together, they could have some impact on North Korea's nuclear program and ambitions, because there's real concern out there that, you know, this is the path that the dictator in North Korea is going. He wants to develop, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles that can deliver, you know, nuclear warheads to, you know, continental U.S., and that's the path he's on. And, you know, you'll have to be stopped one way or the other is sort of the feeling that's emerging. And, you know, I think the thought is if the U.S. and China could work to stop that, it would be better than the U.S. trying to go it alone. But, you know, President Trump is making it very clear that, you know, he's willing to do it by the U.S. alone if that's what it takes.
Mm-hmm. So the leader of China and the leader of America meeting in Mar-a-Lago this weekend will be fairly important.
For sure. And you know, we can expect they're going to be talking about other things, too, including trade. And, you know, the President Trump has been very vocal that he thinks there's an imbalance between the U.S. and China on trade that needs to be addressed. You know, during the campaign, he talked a lot about how he thought China was manipulating its currency that, you know, had a deleterious effect to the United States. You know, he said he was going to label China a currency manipulator the first day in office. That didn't happen, and that's the purview of the Treasury Department, and we've seen no action along those lines from that arena. But, you know, clearly there's going to be a lot to talk about when they get together at Mar-a-Lago.
But they're not golfing, I read.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen the agenda, but, you know, famously when the Japanese prime minister went to Mar-a-Lago, they did golf, and I think the president feels like that is an icebreaker, if nothing else. But I have no idea if the Chinese president golfs or not.
Yeah. Somewhere over the weekend, I heard that China got rid of all its golf courses.
Oh, is that true?
I think so. Well, I don't know if it's true or not. I heard that, but it was somebody who seemed to know what he or she was talking about. At any rate, thanks, Mike, very much for your call. Andrea in Managua. Hi, Andrea.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Mark. During the presidential campaigns, Trump stood on that stage in front of the national television and said that Russia should hack the Democratic headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And I never hear anything about that, why he was never called to task on that type of a statement. Is it just that anything that is so irresponsible, other people aren't allowed to do it, but he is allowed to indulge in this type of irresponsible behavior? Why isn't this act ever talked about? And I'll take my answer off.
Thanks, Andrea, for the call.
Well, I think it is talked about. Maybe not, you know, brought up as much as you'd like or as prominently as you might like, but it is mentioned as, you know, part of the concerns that some people have about, you know, the possible ties between Trump and his campaign and the Russians. Because you're right, he did talk about how, you know, he'd like to see Russia hack, you know, the emails to get more information. I think he said, you know, the missing emails from Hillary Clinton he wanted the Russians to find. But beyond that, you know, there's been concern that at almost every turn, President Trump and then candidate Trump was willing to defend Vladimir Putin, you know, and almost, you know, ahead of U.S. interests sometimes. And that caused a lot of puzzlement. You know, why would, in this case, a U.S. presidential candidate be, you know, supporting
a Russian, you know, president, dictator, whatever you want to call him, and in some cases Russian interests over U.S. interests. So that just sort of fueled the, you know, questions about, you know, was there some kind of relationship or connection between Russia and the Trump campaign? And I think it is fueling, you know, sort of this push to get more answers about that, and, you know, might have even been part of, you know, the effort to get an investigation, which started during the presidential campaign.
I guess that the FBI investigation, from what I've read, is so wide-ranging that it would appear that it's going to take a long time to figure out what's going on here, that there were, I've heard anywhere from 1,000 to 15,000 people who were paid, I don't know by whom in Russia, or who these people were, if they were in Russia hacking or in the United States or wherever, 1,000 to 15,000 people who were paid to be hackers of the DNC. I mean, it's just incredible. You've got all these dead Russians who've been appearing. This is a really big story that almost reads like a spy novel, doesn't it? But it's evidently under investigation, and it must be hard to come up with answers to some of this.
Yeah, it really does read that way. I think you're right. And it seems to have a lot of tentacles, too, where it's not just sort of a clear-cut, here's one path that we need to investigate, and it could be that once they, you know, start down investigating a path, it might open up other avenues they have to investigate. I mean, I have really no sense of how long this would take, but, you know, that's sort of been my experience that these always take a long time, and this one in particular because of the complexity and frankly, the sensitivity of what we're, you know, what's being investigated could actually take longer as well.
And what does it do to this administration? Does it, as people were saying, put a cloud over the administration, or are they still able to carry on with their legislative agenda?
I think it probably does put a cloud over it, only from the standpoint of it's sort of an unresolved element out there that, you know, I'm not sure how what extent it would affect the legislative agenda or what it plays into that, but it clearly has an impact on foreign policy, you know, and just raises questions about, well, you know, how does this affect, you know, U.S.-Russia relationship? You know, you saw the ambassador of the U.N., Nikki Haley, question about this on the Sunday talk shows. You know, does it affect her ability to deal with Russia? And, you know, is she getting marching orders from the president to go easy on Russia? So you're seeing those kind of questions asked, and it just sort of plays into sort of overall uncertainty about, you know, how U.S. relates with Russia. And is any of that colored by what's happening with the investigation or concerns about how it might be looked in context of the investigation?
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Nobody's answering the question, do you think there should be an independent probe? Do you have faith that the FBI and the Senate Intelligence Committee, because the House committee is not doing anything now, it's questionable as to whether or not they'll be able to continue. Do you think there should be an independent probe? Do you feel that we'll, year from now, understand what's going on here? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political you're listening to here on the Ideas Network, and our guest is Mark Niquette, government reporter for Bloomberg News. Stan in Madison is next. Hello, Stan.
Oh, thank you. I have a question for your guest concerning this fiasco that occurred on Friday, where Trump was supposed to sign an executive order. Mm-hmm. The vice president made the announcement. Then Trump said a few garbled words and walked out without signing the executive order. The vice president reached up, tried to bring him back into the room. He walked out. And then they picked up the executive order, and it was signed separately. That was supposed to be a photo op also. The whole question now comes up of the mental state of this president and his emotional state. Apparently, a question was asked just at the end of before the signing by a reporter. And it looks like that threw him for a loop. In view of this and the fact that his whole medical examination, the letter that he presented from his doctor at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, that letter is nonsense and doesn't show anything about his physical and mental state. Isn't it time now that we get an independent assessment of his physical and mental state.
Mark.
You know, I'm not sure, as I'm thinking about this, whether the president, you know, gets... I know there's sort of routine checkups that are done, and we'll see, at least past presidents have, sort of reports given of, you know, how the president did, what, you know, the vitals were and such forth. I'm not sure I've read anything or heard anything about how President Trump's going to handle that. You know, as far as what the caller was talking about with this meeting on Friday, it's an example, I think, of how, you know, the Russia investigation and questions about Russia is affecting, mm-hmm. you know, what's happening in the government. In this case, it was a press conference where, the caller's right, it was, I think, meant to be a photo op signing these executive orders on trade. And what happens at these kind of events and what's been happening, and I think will continue to happen, is the reporters who are there to, you know, essentially cover the event are using it as an opportunity to pepper the president with questions. In this case, they were asking about, you know, the Russia investigation and, you know, whether he thought immunity should be granted to Michael Flynn. And, you know, that's not something the president wanted to answer then. So the caller's right. He walked into the next room and apparently he signed the orders, the executive orders, in, you know, behind closed doors as opposed to in the room where they normally do it for the photo op. So, I mean, again, this is just an example of how sort of, you know, the questions about Russia are sort of coloring everything else that's going on right now.
Right. And he has, evidently, maybe it's more than that as of today, this figure as of yesterday, he's done 13 tweets in less than 2 weeks protesting congressional and FBI Russia investigations are false. The real story, he says, surveillance and leaking and find the leakers. He's been tweeting that for a long time. A couple questions. Why does he keep doing that? Would it be better for him to just drop the matter entirely? It kind of draws more attention to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, on one level, it draws more attention to it. But I think part of the strategy is to, you know, maybe change the subject or, you know, distract attention away from, you know, the meat of this. And that is questions about whether his campaign or Mr. Trump himself was working or collaborating with the Russians in any way. And you played a clip from Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, on Sunday, talking about Michael Flynn. Well, he sort of addressed this question or this phenomenon of, you know, the president tweeting, and he came right out and said it. He thought that this was an attempt to distract and divert attention away from, you know, the heart of, you know, what this investigation is about, you know, and move it more towards leaks or something that, you know, it would take attention away from the president. And the quote he used, Adam Schiff, in that interview that you played, he said, you know, I would tell people whenever they see the president use the word fake, it ought to set off alarm bells. And I think that is what was really going on here. So his suggestion, again, is that, you know, the president's just trying to, like, change the subject, divert attention.
Mm-hmm. Stan, thanks so much for your call. Mary in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hello. See, I'm just wondering if you know, has there ever been a president before in history that has appointed his children and children-in-law to such high positions in the government?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the history to that. It probably has happened, but probably not to the extent that we're seeing under President Trump. Certainly, you know, in this case, his daughter and son-in-law, you know, having such prominent positions within the administration, not just sort of, you know, kitchen cabinet advisor type roles. And it has caused questions, you know, particularly when you think about the business connections that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump have, you know, coming into the White House. Normally, when, you know, a government employee or a White House official is named, they go through a whole process of, you know, offering financial disclosures and going through ethics review to make sure there's nothing in their background, their stock holdings or business connections that would present a conflict of interest in their official capacities. And, you know, if there's a question about it, you know, often there's a plan that's put forward that would have the person, you know, divest of certain financial holdings, for example, put stocks in a blind trust, you know, do things that would remove any potential question about conflict of interest. And that's just not very easy to do when we're talking about relatives of the president. You know, Jared Kushner, for example, did some of that. You know, there were some shuffling of his business interests to either divest or, you know, remove his control, but, you know, not in every case. And when you think about the broader Trump organization, you know, that's still an ongoing business run by two other sons who are not in the government, mm-hmm. but, you know, the president is still their father. And, you know, it's just, it brings a whole level of questions about the connection between public and private as, you know, public duties are being dispensed here.
Hmm. What's the deal with so many people in the administration, all of the people in the family, all of this money? My God, it's a lot of money. It's billions of dollars in it. People are billionaires. What happened to the idea of just having some regular old people, you know, who aren't billionaires, be involved in government? It's incredible how much money these people have.
Yeah, and we're seeing sort of the extent of that. There were disclosures filed on Friday that they're not precise. In a lot of cases, it's just a range of assets that are held or net worth. But, you know, they're big numbers no matter what. And you're right. It sort of, you know, cuts against the image that sometimes we think of public service, right, that these folks are coming into government, and
yes,
you know, they're not rich people. They're there to do the people's business. And you know, the argument that President Trump has often made about this is that, you know, if somebody is smart enough to amass a fortune in business, that probably means he or she is pretty smart, can bring something to government, and in some cases a perspective that doesn't exist in government or should be there for government. But you know, part of what we saw in those financial disclosures on Friday is just, as you said, just the amount of money, and then across all kinds of different sectors. It's not just people coming from the public sector who, you know, built their fortunes in real estate or some kind of private enterprise. You know, we're seeing folks like, you know, Steve Bannon, who, you know, has made more than $1 million just on sort of the media empire he's had, or people like Kellyanne Conway, the counselor to the president, who has made a lot of money in sort of the political world, consulting. And so it's, you know, it's not just sort of the, you know, business titans who are making a lot of money. It's folks making money even off the process itself.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, and you're listening to All Things Political for this Monday. You always hear it Monday at this time. A listener wants to fill us in. There is no peace treaty officially ending the Korean War, hence the DMZ and the 50-plus years of hostilities involving North Korea. We were talking about Russia quite a bit earlier. This was a documentary. Well, it wasn't. It was an interview. I taped it. I haven't seen it yet. That David Axelrod had with Senator John McCain on CNN, and he asked him what McCain thought about Trump's relationship with Putin. We'll hear this and return to your phone calls in a minute, so stay with us. Here's Senator McCain and David Axelrod.
What O'Reilly said, it stands out in my memory. He said, he is a killer. And the president said, well, aren't we killers too? That was so appalling to me, to have a moral equivalency between this fellow who is, I don't know how many deaths he's responsible for example, in Chechnya, where he put down any opposition with great killing.
There were several assassinations just last week.
Yeah, one guy was thrown out of a fourth story window. So to state that there's some moral equivalency between an imperfect nation, that's the United States of America, and Vladimir Putin is appalling.
All right, let's go to more phone calls. Ben in Sparta is next. Hi, Ben.
Hi. You had asked if anyone approves of the independent investigation. I would say I definitely do, but there's an unknown. I don't know what the precedent is for an investigation of that, you know, type and magnitude, and what kind of institution or person would be given an authority to do such an investigation. I don't know what is there.
Well, I guess our guidance would be Watergate, wouldn't it, Mark?
Watergate, or there's sometimes thought that we could set up a commission like the one that existed after 9/11 that sort of had the authority to look at all aspects of what happened with the attacks on our country and come out with some kind of report with findings at the end of it. But you're right, Watergate would be one precedent, and it would have to be a congressional kind of action that sets this up, and I think that's why you've seen some reluctance. I mean, Congress seems to say, well, this is a job that we can do, and, you know, it could be that, you know, what we've seen happen with sort of the unraveling of the House investigation, that could be, you know, some impetus to maybe get some kind of, you know, independent panel or special prosecutor, something that, you know, the public could have, you know, maybe more confidence in, that this is going to be an independent review and its findings you can trust.
Well, you'd need a whole lot more Republican support that would go beyond John McCain and Lindsey Graham, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's what I think. You know, for Congress to approve this, it would take
right.
that, and I don't think that's there yet.
Right. No, far from it. Thanks very much for the call, Ben. Claire in Madison. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Claire.
I think we Americans, as a whole, have a huge, huge problem with credibility with this whole administration, from Trump on down. Trump, obviously, his business conflicts, enriching himself at Mar-a-Lago at taxpayer expense, total lack of political acumen, Republican Party backing him, and they would be exploding if any of these things were on the Democratic side. Nunez, who can believe him at this point? And even the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, lying in his confirmation hearing. We can't believe anybody.
So what's to be done then, Claire, in your mind? Do you think we need an independent prosecutor? Do you think that Russia's going to cause an impeachment of this president? What do you think?
Well, if Trump continues the way he has been acting, I think his days may be numbered. I think we definitely need to be going into these investigations much further. But that's another issue with Sessions as the Attorney General. I know he has recused himself from these investigations, but does that really mean anything? It's still his departments that are doing the investigating on Trump right now.
Mark.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, where we are today, because I was thinking even back during the campaign about how, you know, the political climate, if nothing else, has changed, you know, where, you know, what in the past would clearly have been disqualifying or, you know, cause people to, you know, stop supporting a candidate just didn't matter anymore. And I think the Russia situation is
yes.
a good example of that, where we've had, you know, suggestions that, again, where, you know, in this case, you know, candidate Trump, you know, put Russian interests ahead of U.S. or, you know, was, you know, essentially accepting, you know, Vladimir Putin's word over U.S. generals. And it occurred to me during the campaign, well, if this had happened 2 years ago, I don't know how far back you'd have to go. You know, there would have been an uproar like, boy, how could we, you know, not be taking U.S. interests or even, you know, being any kind of cozy, you know, relationship with Russia. But that's not the world we live in today anymore, apparently. And I think a lot of it has to do with just sort of the general unhappiness there is in this country with the status quo. I mean, I think that's a lot of why, you know, Donald Trump was elected, you know, the sense that, you know, what had been before, what was working now, the systems we have in place just weren't effective, weren't helping, you know, enough people didn't feel like it was working for them. And they were willing to sort of look beyond the status quo to a candidate like Donald Trump. And I guess that extends to, you know, what we may have thought about our relations with Russia or our place in the world. And, you know, what's up is down and sort of a different world we live in.
What's up is down. I think you're absolutely right. What's up is down. What do you think about Bill O'Reilly? This $13 million paid in settlement money to five different women, and there may be more, for sexual harassment. $13 million? Does Fox have a problem, or is this another situation where what's up is down, you know, who cares? We like listening to him.
Well, see, I saw another news report today that there's a separate lawsuit filed or being pursued as well against Fox, against Roger Ailes, you know, the former chairman of Fox.
Yes.
I don't know. We'll see how that plays out with Fox. It, you know, it hasn't hurt their ratings, put it that way.
No.
And that's true. I guess that's one benefit of all this upheaval is, you know, if you're in the cable news business, you know, it's been good for business.
It's been phenomenal, hasn't it? CNN is making all kinds of money.
And ratings up and down, are ratings all across the board are up, and, you know, that extends to left or right. I mean, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, you know, people are tuning in, and they're interested
right.
in following what's happening, for sure.
Don't you wish, though, Mark, as I watch too much of this, I'm sure, but I keep looking for somebody to do, particularly on something like the Russia story, for resources to be sent so we get a substantial, fair-minded documentary on all of this instead of a lot of people just talking about it. Why don't we get some investigation here?
Well, I think you are seeing that, and particularly in the print world where I come from, you're seeing a lot of resources being devoted to an investigative reporting. Places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, for example, are adding reporters and staffing up and really, you know, taking seriously the responsibility that the press has to do, you know, good investigative work. And on the TV side, I guess I continue to be disappointed with sort of the fracturing of our media, where it just becomes an echo chamber where people who want their own opinions and predispositions validated will tune into the source that will do that, and we just don't get, you know, enough of a broad understanding of an issue or even opposing voices that could help us understand and inform our own opinions.
Yes. Yeah. You're right. Claire, thanks for the call. We have time for a couple more phone calls, and you could get through if you've been really anxious to talk. Give us a call now. 800-486-8655 is the number. Laura in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. I've just read that Trump is associating Hillary Clinton with Russian affairs and uranium. And I'm just wondering why the FBI is not investigating the primary election fraud between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Could Russia have interfered with a part of that in order to set up election extortion?
I don't know. Maybe they are. We don't know what's being investigated, do we, Mark?
No, we don't know the scope of it. And there were questions about, you know, was Hillary Clinton receive, you know, debate questions ahead of time through the DNC, and that's not necessarily a Russia connection. But you're right, we don't know the full scope of the investigation. But I think they're sort of the focus is going to be more on, you know, Donald Trump, given that he won. He's the president, right? And I know he keeps talking about, you know, Hillary Clinton and bringing up tweets. He did so again today. You know, why aren't people looking at, you know, Hillary's connection to the Russians and so forth? But, you know, as he also will tell you more often than not, you know, he won.
Right. Yes, he did win. Oh, what a time we are living in. It's just the other thing is you want to have substantial conversations on all of these major issues, too. And instead, we're just caught up in this tweet storm and these Russian probes, and there's so much at stake in terms of governing that just isn't happening. These are really weird times. But to go back to Russia, because these times are weird and what's up is down, it really seems to me as though the American public, we're the people who voted. We vote. You know, it's our government, for heaven's sake. You would like to have some really clear understanding of what's going on so that the Senate Intelligence Committee may be doing a fine job, but why aren't we hearing all their witnesses?
Yeah, it's a tricky balance with this kind of investigation, because some of the, you know, material and information you need as part of the investigation will be classified. I mean, it'll just be information that cannot be made public. And, you know, I think the, you know, the tricky balance is you want to have as much, you know, be transparent and be public as possible without compromising national security, if that's what's at stake. So this type of investigation, I think, is particularly tricky from that standpoint. But you're right. I mean, the more the public can know and find out and understand, you know, the better informed we're all going to be.
Mm-hmm. So how was going to school at Lawrence?
I really like Lawrence. I grew up not too far from Lawrence, but, you know, staying on campus, it was almost like I was in some other state or some other faraway place. And Lawrence was just a great place for, you know, a good liberal arts background. I didn't have a journalism program. I kind of knew I wanted to do journalism, but, you know, the sort of the preparation with a history degree at Lawrence was perfect for journalism because of the research skills you learn and, you know, some of the training as a historian. You know, you could put right to work as a journalist.
I would imagine so. And what a time to be a journalist this is. Well, thank you, Mark, so much for being with us again. It was a great hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our guest, Mark Niquette, he's a government reporter for Bloomberg. I mentioned Wisconsin. He's a native of Kaukauna, Wisconsin, and got his degree in history from Lawrence University. He has worked for Bloomberg covering municipal finance, state government issues, national politics. He covered state government politics and election issues at the Dispatch in Columbus, Ohio, and has worked in Youngstown, Ohio at the vindicator. And we thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to Colleen Duvall for producing this hour, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. I don't know if you saw yesterday's cover story of the New York Times Magazine section. It's a very lengthy and incredibly good article about the president and his running against Congress and now how he needs Congress. Lots of background information about meetings that were held some years ago between Bannon and Sessions, and really fascinating the idea that would allow for the victory of Donald Trump in 2016. So stay with us after the news.